Welcome to the Covert Narcissism Podcast. I'm your host, Renee Swanson. Welcome to the Covert Narcissism Podcast. I'm your host, Renee Swanson, and I thank you so much for joining me today. I have a very special guest here today. His name is Brandon Chadwick, and Brandon is from the Narcissist Apocalypse Podcast, and I'm thrilled to have him here. So, Brandon, you're on this mission of spreading the word on narcissism, too. What brought you to that mission?
So, my show started off as a mistake.
Okay.
And what happened was I was writing a blog for my old website that was called How to Survive the Narcissist Apocalypse, which I then started to like form into a book. And then I started a podcast as the character from my book. And about, I say three episodes in, it might have been more, but I think it was like three episodes in, my friend came to help me. I noticed something was wrong. And all of a sudden, we changed the banter. And I started asking serious questions about what was going on about her previous relationship, not the one that she was currently in. And for some reason, instead of, you know, it was a humor show, so it didn't fit for me to quit that episode out, but I did. And many weeks later, I got a response from someone. We had one listener, it turns out, at that time, 5 years ago. And that person said, don't do that other stuff. You know, that interview helped me. Do that again. So I found a stranger who came from a dysfunctional family and talked to that person and quit that episode out. And, you know, we got along and we had the same personality. So we got along really well. I could have finished his sentences. And then again, many weeks later, I got an email from another stranger. It said, that helped me, do that again. And then I changed my Instagram to the name of what my book was, but now it's been shortened to Narcissist Apocalypse. And people from all, I just put out a thing like, this is what I'm doing now. Does anyone want to be a guest on the show? And I started getting emails from people from all over the world.
Wow.
And so slowly but surely, I started a show by accident, interviewing survivors of narcissistic abuse, domestic violence, coercive control. And slowly it just, you know, I think at the time I was one of the only people doing like straight on recordings of people's stories from beginning to end. No bells and whistles, like no music, no interludes, no like, not doing like a true crime show would do something or an entertainment show. It was just kind of like, if you were at a podium at like an AA meeting or something like that, now tell your story to everyone there to help everyone feel validated and supported. And I think that was the first kind of mission of the show, was this is validating and supportive for people who don't want to hear clinical like stories from people on podcasts and learn better, get validated better through someone's story. And that kind of just snowballed from there. So it started off as like, we're here to validate. And then it's like, how do we validate? And then also educate. And then, you know, things like that. And what are the different types of education you can give people? And what are the different types of validation you can give people? And I think the strangest validation, or the thing that I didn't think of, was like, everyone thinks it's like, this is a story, these are the things, but feelings became a really big thing, which is what I think is missed a lot when it comes to clinical, you know, descriptions of what is going on and, you know, information that's given that way, because so many people have feelings that they don't know if other people are having those feelings.
Right.
And those things are the things that are missed a lot. And people don't sometimes have an idea how to put those feelings into words. So we're giving people vocabulary of feelings of specific situations. And then someone can go, I didn't have that exact situation, but I know that feeling. And now, and it, then it starts to become like, how can we help people translate their story to other people, to support people, to lawyers, to their doctor, their psychiatrist, their therapist, to their friends in a way that their friend would understand, or whoever would understand in a better way, so they could get help. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much trauma involved with everything that's happened, and you don't know what's real a lot of the time or not real. So hearing other people and being able to take those exact words from someone and then transfer them over and knowing like, oh, that how that person said it, that's exactly how it is. So in a way, we're creating like inertia, like movement and like a dialogue within someone to help understand the little tiny details that are often, I think, missed when dealing with someone who's a narcissistic abuser or coercive controller that sometimes you don't even understand. So that's kind of how things started and how we kind of started moving forward from there.
That's awesome. And I love what you're saying about the difference between trying to learn this in a clinical environment and learning it just from listening to conversations like they were at a coffee shop, you know, and all of a sudden somebody says something and you go, oh my gosh, I can relate to that. I get that. I understand that. And the validation that it just makes your world all of a sudden more real, what you're dealing with and what you're going through, and lets you connect with those feelings. So I think that's awesome.
It's not a show for everyone. And I say that in the sense of sometimes people, it's too triggering for people because it's too real. You know, sometimes the clinical stuff is the easier thing to do it. They can process it in that way and they don't have to go into maybe some traumatic memories. But for some people, it's the right way to do things. And you bring up the coffee shop. It's like you're sitting at a coffee shop and you're hearing someone tell their story and you're kind of sitting there and you're like, you want to be involved in that conversation. And you're trying to find an in. And you don't want to be like you're eavesdropping. So we're kind of giving you an opportunity to like listen in to someone's thing and then be part of the conversation. You know, if you eventually do want to share your story, and because we're always looking for stories. And the other thing would be like we have our Instagram page and we have our own support group as well to kind of be more involved in talking with other people, or at least kind of sharing your experience, because most of our stuff on Instagram is quotes from our episode. But it's been a ride, I'd say.
No doubt. Where did you come up with the name Narcissist Apocalypse?
That is a good, well, it's a pretty simple answer. There was a book called, The Zombie Survival Guide, I think that what its name was. There was a couple books. One was written by Max Brooks, who is Mel Brooks's son. And I used the format of that book to format my blog because it was an interesting format. So, you know, everyone talks about a zombie apocalypse. And my book had a lot to do with social media, which has never been made, by the way, because once I started doing the show, I was like, this is more important. But I was like, oh, that's interesting. Zombie apocalypse. And, you know, what's going on with kids today? What's going on with everyone today? You know, we're kind of living in this narcissist apocalypse. So that's kind of how it started. And, it's the way people find the show. I was actually out. It was probably very Canadian of me how I said that. I was out somewhere because I used a poster around town. I'm in Toronto and I put my poster up in places and I went to a function and it was for a premiere of a very, very, very small independent movie. And I'm at the bar and I didn't really want to talk about anything to do with work or anything like that. And one person says to me, what do you do? And I'm like, I did kind of try to avoid it. And then they asked me, well, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I'm a podcaster. And they go, what do you podcast about? I go, well, my podcast is called Narcissist Apocalypse. And they go, I've seen your sign. It's a political podcast, correct? And I go, no, it has nothing to do with that. And that's when I realized I had to change my sign because people didn't understand what the show was about. So now when I poster, the last time I postered, it says maybe Narcissist Apocalypse in small writing, but the big writing out loud, like that you can see from far away, says domestic violence. So the right person walks up to the poster.
I think that's awesome. Okay. So in your own background, do you have experience with narcissism?
I would say that my background, I come from a dysfunctional family. We'll just put it that way.
Sure.
And I think I just have a good understanding of, you know, where certain feelings come from. And I just have a very like investigative nature. So understanding the idea of if X person does this, how do you respond? And if X person does that, how do you respond? And then everyone will respond in different ways. And when person A does X, that won't work on everyone. So it became a real investigative kind of thing for me that everyone is different and there's so many different variables and what one abuser might try to do to one person and that person would walk away right off the bat. For someone else, it might be, no, that's attractive to me to, or maybe they came from chaos. So chaos is okay. So really within the process of even doing the show, helping people understand why those things might have worked on them and to help them feel less shame about it because, you know, it all depends, you know, for someone else, it might not have worked, but for you, it was like the perfect person. So just kind of helping people figure out why they reacted in specific ways, why they went along with things. And that it's okay. And to try and start pointing out why those things would work, whether they came into the relationship with issues of a specific kind or within the relationship that the abuser just did a very good job of, you know, eroding their identity completely to the point where like who they were at the beginning is not who they were at the end. And I'm a big movie fan. So there's the director, Jordan Peele. He made Get Out, made the movie Nope. He made the movie Us. And he explained horror. And it's a perfect analogy for a narcissistic abuse relationship, domestic violence in a lot of cases is as the horror gets worse and goes on a downward trend to like a little bit more, 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 more. The other person is seeing this. And when you're watching a horror movie, sometimes people say, leave, like get out of there, don't come back. But his interpretation is as you're making a horror movie, you show someone just enough that they are going to question themselves, was that real? And as they're going along, they're still able to question, is this real? Is this not real? Is this real? Is this not real? They're picking up more information as they're going along to prove that this thing is real, but the audience is still sticking with it and believing the horror film because the character has enough to believe that it is not real to stay and to still be in this horror. And I found that really interesting that that's kind of how one of these relationships works until the end where it's just like boom, 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 and you can't deny what's happening anymore. And then, you know, there's the end of the movie, which with domestic violence, narcissistic abuse, so the one thing different would be that ending could happen and there could be an addiction to what's going on and you could be going back and forth for a while. But for the most part, that analogy is, you know, an abusive relationship, a narcissistic abusive relationship.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And I think we kind of, you know, and living it myself, you kind of, is this real? Is this not real? Is this happening? I think it's happening. What's going on? And so that back and forth, like you're describing in a horror movie, I think that's a great analogy. Until you reach that point, you can't deny it anymore. And it is right there slapping you in the face.
It's right there in the face. So I guess my question for you, Renee, how did you get involved in doing this? What was your experience? And tell us a little bit about your show and what you do.
Okay, so I'm happy to do that. And I got started because of what I was living. Like, this was not expected. This was not an expected path for me. I didn't start it, you know, because of writing some book. I didn't get on a mission expecting to be podcasting. This came out of nowhere for me. The marriage I was living was rough. I was struggling in it. I didn't understand. I was putting in so much effort and energy into this marriage to make it work. We were raising two boys, and I was determined. I was committed. This was a marriage for life. And as about 15 years went by, I finally did reach that point that I couldn't deny how I was feeling anymore. How I was feeling was very broken, very small, very less than, pushed down, exhausted. And I started to research a little bit and started to see, okay, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? And I ran across narcissism. And this actually started with a therapist that I finally went to a therapist. And within a few minutes of that conversation, he said, you need to learn about narcissism. And that started me on that, you know, that that rabbit hole of diving in to learn about narcissism. And when you read something and you know it's true, like your heart, like it's like you were talking about, is you're eavesdropping on that conversation. And all of a sudden you're going, man, I can relate to that. I can understand that. And they're putting your life into words that you didn't have. I didn't have those words until I started reading and went, oh, check mark, check mark, check mark. These are the words. And so in, you know, you read it from books, you're back to the clinical side of it. But I thought, there's got to be people out there that can relate to what I'm living. I can't be the only person in the world living this. So I jumped on Facebook. And I started a Facebook group actually with one person, because you got to have a friend to start a Facebook group. Can't start a Facebook group by yourself. You got to have one person to start it with. So it was a friend of mine who, she didn't have anything to do with narcissism, but I said, hey, can I start this group with you? And she's like, sure. So she joined the group with me, and I don't think she's still a member of it today. But then people started finding it and people started joining it. I actually created a little ad so that I could maybe find other people who'd want to join. And when they did, we started sharing our stories. It was so validating to me. I'm not alone. I'm not alone. There's other people who get this. And it started this mission of just, I want to, you know, validate their story while they're validating mine. And that trade-off was so powerful. And it just grew. It kept growing and it kept growing. And now today, that Facebook group has over 58,000 people in it. But that is a community where people are helping each other. And that just became an absolute mission for me. I am no longer in the marriage. That marriage has dissolved. But then I had a friend who said to me, you ought to podcast. You ought to tell people your story and get word out more. And that's where it started. And I just started creating this podcast and people started resonating with it and the stories I was telling. And I shared my story. Like, most of my podcast is my story. But then it evolved and now it's been other people sharing their story there. But as I went along, I got the emails too, where people are like, hey, you are putting this into words that I didn't have. And thank you. I needed words to be able to describe this. And it became such an integral part of my healing journey that I couldn't stop. Like, it just became a mission then, because every time I would put more things into words and people were resonating with those words, my healing just exploded because of the relationship I had come from. So for me, it was a personal journey from my background.
And what's the thing that surprised you, what you learned the most during that process?
The most surprising thing I've learned is how many people are out there who are living this. Like, that has been incredibly shocking to me. Like, I knew I wasn't alone, but I had no idea how widespread narcissism is. You know, you talk about the narcissism, you know, apocalypse, that, yeah, it's like an apocalypse. They're everywhere. But it's also, when you see narcissism in somebody, we all have some elements of narcissism. We all have some dysfunction. You know, you say you come from a dysfunctional family, so say we all. You know, we all have elements of that. And so it has also been very eye-opening to me that just because we might see narcissism kind of everywhere doesn't mean everybody out there is a narcissist. It's very easy to, when you've come from that kind of a relationship, a lengthy marriage, it's very easy to get overly reactive, to feel like everybody's a narcissist. But it's been a really good journey for me to learn that those narcissistic traits that are self-protecting, when kept in check with empathy and compassion, actually can create a healthy balance inside a person.
And obviously it was a lot of work done within you, you know, because I think of my show as part self-discovery as well. So was there a part of you that went through a healing process through this journey that you didn't expect to find? And, you know, how did you then go about that healing within the community, I guess?
So within the community, it's, you know, my logo for the Covert Narcissism Podcast, that's the name of my show. And it is focused on covert narcissism, which is that, you know, the more subtle form of narcissism, the one that's really invisible, like you really are trying to catch a ghost or you're trying to hold on to a shadow. And the logo is four heads. You're looking down from the sky, four heads with arms wrapped around each other. And the value of community, I think, has been the biggest piece of my healing journey. That I'm not doing this alone. I'm not isolated. And so with the podcast, as it continued to spread and more people heard about it and more people started reaching out to me, and then I created group sessions where we actually meet on Zoom in small groups. Those group sessions are some of the best friends now that I've ever met. Like, they are people who are being real and being genuine with each other. And so I think for me, the biggest way that podcasting has been such a huge part of my healing has been it's become a safe place for my feelings to be expressed, where, I mean, there's no judgment, no self-judgment. It's just being able to have emotional safety. And then within the community, that Facebook community and the people that are doing my group sessions, that emotional safety that none of us had within our home has been integral in the healing.
So you found within podcasting and the community, you found your voice.
Yes.
And you started to be able to really express all of the things that you were not allowed to for a very long time, you know, and as your voice starts to be heard, no matter what you're saying or what you're talking about, there's just this freedom of taking your power back in that way and being able to be authentic in that way with other people and having no fear of saying how you're feeling or saying, I want to do this today, or
absolutely.
Even you know what? I'm not going to clean this thing today, and that's going to be okay, and no one's going to tell me what to do, you know, because I just don't have the energy. And to be able to say, I don't have the energy for this. So it sounds like you're creating within that community. The community is its own boundary space, mm-hmm. to feel free to have boundaries, to go in and out in the community and be who you are. and be involved, but then some days it's okay to not be involved.
Absolutely.
And to be okay with that.
Absolutely. There's an element of safety that is so needed in our world. And it's not, when you're dealing with covert narcissism, it's not so much about physical safety as it is about emotional safety, which has a physical element to it. So there is, you know, an emotional threat definitely has a physical element with inside of you. There's no way you can't say it's not physical. But I think of the analogy of, if you've got a youngster at school and he is not feeling safe, sitting in his chair, trying to learn multiplication tables from his teacher, but he's not feeling safe. Maybe that threat is a bully that's sitting beside him. Maybe that threat is because of, you know, abuse that's going on at home. And so he can't drop the hypervigilance. And so he's not feeling safe, or he's, you know, afraid of a shooter coming in the school because of a news story he heard. So you've got this child sitting there not feeling safe. That child's not going to learn the multiplication tables right that minute. You can't, because you're so focused on that lack of safety. And it interferes with any ability to learn and grow. So you take that child and you put them in an environment where they can drop their guard. They can relax. They can drop the hypervigilance. They can trust. In this environment now, their growth and their learning explodes. Okay, all of a sudden now they can grasp, oh, these multiplication tables really weren't that hard. You know, all of a sudden academically, everything is clicking for them. Socially, they're going to be more comfortable because the guard is relaxed and they're able to connect now with other people. The same thing is true of somebody who's living in a narcissistic relationship. You aren't safe. You are not emotionally, psychologically, mentally safe. Your system knows that, so the guard is up. Well, your growth and your learning at that point is very limited. As you leave these relationships, if you continue the hypervigilance inside your own head, which you do, it's very common for quite a while, that hypervigilance still interferes with your growth because you haven't figured out how to relax yet. You know, covert narcissism gets inside of you and you start judging yourself. You start, you know, guarding against yourself. You start gaslighting yourself. So as you start to find your community where you can put that guard down, where you can hear a story and go, oh my gosh, I understand that. And you share your story and nobody's judging you. You start learning to put your own guard down. And as you do, your own self-judgment goes down and down and down. All of a sudden, your learning and your growth explodes because you found safety. So finding that group, that community, that space, that coffee shop, whatever it is, that friend, that family member, whatever it is, where you can find that kind of safety is crucial when you're dealing with a narcissistic relationship.
And you have done an episode about the narcissist prayer.
Yes.
And that prayer is, that didn't happen. And if it did, it wasn't that bad. And if it was, that's not a big deal. And if it is, then it's not my fault. And if it was, I didn't mean it. And if I did, you deserved it. So for you, when it comes to the idea of covert narcissism, what does all of that encompass?
So all of that encompasses the way that everything from the covert narcissist perspective can constantly be shifted and changed and manipulated to make everything your fault, your job to fix, your responsibility, your shortcomings. Everything is targeted at you. So you deserved it, or you're remembering it wrong, or you're interpreting it wrong. Whatever it is, you are always the one that's wrong. They take no ownership, no accountability of their own. And so the only way this relationship works is if you're willing to do all of that work. When I look back at my own marriage and realize I was the one who was always giving all the way, like jumping across the Grand Canyon. He's on this side, I'm on this side. I have to go all the way across to his side all the time in order for this to work.
Were they big with silent treatments?
So the silent treatment for me in my marriage was not days on end or weeks or months. It was these long, pregnated pauses within a conversation. And I mean long. We would sit in total silence. And that silence was just pounding. Like, it's just this incredibly loud silence where you're not allowed to twitch. You're not allowed to move. If I, you know, even got up to walk across the room, then it was, you know, hey, you need to listen to me. And, but it was these long, pregnated moments of just intense silence.
And did you think that you, at that point, that you had done something wrong? So now you're going to be caretaking because of that silence?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Now it was my, you know, that silence was my mind on hyperdrive of what did I do? What is he mad about? What did I say? What did, you know, and then how do I fix it? How do I fix it? Because everything's your job.
Was that, is that like their biggest tactic? How to get you onto their side? So you're not thinking about yourself. You're constantly thinking about them.
Yes. Because this may have started with a conversation of me saying, you know, hey, I really didn't like it when you got mad at me this morning or whatever. It may have started with something simple like that, but then it flips and it flips and it flips. And by the time we get to that silent pause, I am now working as hard as I can to figure out how to find peace. How do I make peace with him? How do I? And so I'm the one apologizing, even though I'm going, I don't even know what I'm apologizing for, but I don't care. I just want to apologize so that this will get better. So everything flips where it becomes all about what I did wrong.
How long was that? Did you say 15 years?
The marriage was 21 years.
21 years of that.
Yes. 21 years of that. 15 years is about when I've really started to realize something's really wrong here. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of when I started that research, but just in a little bit. So I'd peek in the door and I'd be like, no, that's not what it is. And I, because you can live in denial for a long time. So denial at the time is easier to live in than to face the reality of what was in front of me. It was easier to deny it. I can make excuses, stuff my feelings inside, and deny. But if I faced it, it made it real. And that realness of it was too scary for me at times.
And when it came to your healing process in the aftermath, because 21 years is a long time, you know, within your healing process, what were your ups and downs like? And when you're dealing with everyone from your coaching practice to your group, you know, obviously there's going to be people in there that are going to get frustrated that, you know, some people's healing processes are different than everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it within the group that I run as well, that some people are kind of going and, you know, and then you see people that are taking steps back and going forward and taking steps back. And it's hard to, you know, you're giving your best words of support during all of those times. So what do you say to people who are going through a lengthy period of the healing process? Because there's just so much that is, like, I like to call it like a phone cord that's really tangled. You know, you're trying to unwind that cord so at least goes straight, but it's not going to be a linear process. So how do you help people through that process?
So the one of the things that I tell people all the time is this is a very personal journey. Your journey will not look like anybody else's. There's going to be similarities. There's going to be stories that you go, oh my gosh, I think she's reading, you know, from my life, or she's a fly on the wall. And so there's going to be stories that are going to be very similar. But there's always still going to be a very personal element to it. And in that personal journey, you have to find what is the right path for you. And that's it. You know, if the narcissist in your life is going to be mad, whether you do it this way or that way or this way or that way, and keep going down that list of all the different ways you can try it, And if they're going to be mad, no matter which way you do things, stop trying to find the right way for them. Okay. Find the right way for you. But that's hard because you've been living, for me, it was 21 years. I've been living for 21 years trying to find the right way for him. So to reclaim that for me is not a, you know, it was not an instant that it happened. It was, I kind of did, and then I didn't, and I kind of did, and then I didn't. And so it takes time to find that voice again, to find that courage, to claim your reality back and be gracious with yourself while you're doing it. There's no magic answer that says, you know, a lot of people say, just run, just leave, get out of the marriage, run. But it's not that simple. And anybody who tries to tell you that it's that simple, they're not living your life. Okay. And you have to find the right way for you. So the stages of grief in these marriages, you're grieving the loss of what you thought you had. Okay. It's the death of who you thought they were, who you thought you were with them. So this is a grieving process. And the stages of grief, you know, denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and acceptance are not linear. You don't go from denial to bargaining to anger to depression to acceptance. They're all over the place. One day you might be, you know, in denial, but then all of a sudden you're angry. And then now I'm bargaining, trying to take responsibility, but now I'm depressed. And then I accept it just a little bit. Nope, I'm back in denial. And then it's all over the place as you go through this process. And there's no magic answer as to the length of time that should take. So let go of that imperative thinking. There's no should, there's no must, there's no, you have to find the right path that's for you. But in order to do that, you have to start listening to your heart again, which means get all of the hypervigilance off, get all the overthinking and overanalyzing off of you so that you can start listening to your heart once again.
Yeah, I find that the people that come in to some of these relationships that are perfectionists have a very difficult time in the aftermath because, one, they're dealing with in their mind like a failure. Mm-hmm. And then the grieving process becomes its own battleground of there has to be a specific way, or I have to do it this way. And they have to kind of find themselves through that. And we're dealing with so many people that have been told that they're not good enough for a very long period of time. So there's a lot of, it's not every person, but a lot of cases go or relationships go where, you know, the abuser might be attacking their competency in a big way. That might be the thing that they know is going to really get this mm-hmm. person. And that's what they're going to really start to chip away at, that they're not good enough, they're not smart enough, all of those things. So in the healing process, I find when someone has really not thinking that they're good enough and that they're not, the competency stuff has really been chipped away, that it's so ingrained in them at that point that when they're healing, those things are still there, that they're thinking, I'm not even good enough to heal properly. I'm not smart enough to heal properly, because the abuser has done a really good job of, you know, really eroding that sense of self. And that's why, you know, you brought up community, and we've been bringing up community and support today. So it helps so much that when you're in groups and you have other people around, and not just your therapist, if people are going to a therapist, because that's one person, but you have like a community of like different people who can point out to you like, hey, like, look at what you did here. Look at what you did here. And also, like, also within that community, you're not just getting help from other people, you're helping other people. And there's this building block, I think, of community and being in these groups where you might have been told for a very long period of time, as I said before, that you're not good enough, that you're not all of these things that are not true. But now you're starting to help these other people understand those things. And those people are now giving you positive feedback that you are not these things that this other person said. So it becomes this like circle of healing and health, because you're now doing this work to prove this other person wrong, and you don't even realize you're doing it. But a sense of self-confidence and ability starts to be built at that lowest kind of level of community support, you know, to kind of springboard you back into the world after. And I think that's a thing a lot of people don't understand. If you're trying to, if you're out there listening, trying to battle this alone, doing within a community, and this is what they say with like AA and like Alcoholics Anonymous, they try to get people who are addicts into community work and like helping other people to start building up whatever trauma they had been through that made them drink in the first place, to start giving them a sense of worth in a lot of different ways. And I think that's what your community and my community and my support group does, which is to, you're getting help, but you're getting help in two ways. The second way you might not be seen.
Right. No, you're very much so right with that. And it's a mutual, it's like completing the circuit of an electrical current. You know, when you're helping them and they're helping you, it's in helping others how much you end up growing yourself, you know, and helping yourself. And it, I want to go back to what you said about they chip away at your competency, which is 100% true. And as they chip away, though, the other piece of it is they are putting themselves as the higher, you know, authority on knowledge. So they're chipping away at your competency at the same time that they're making you more dependent on them. They are the only person who can help you. They are the only person who you need to turn to for advice, and they isolate you from so many other people. So it's kind of a double whammy there, where you are feeling less than, and, you know, worthless and not good enough. And they are the only person that you can lean on to get help or to get, you know, more knowledge or to get more understanding, and they set that environment up. So when you get into a community where you're with other victims of this and people who understand it, then you have people who are not doing that to you. They're not chipping away your competence, and they're not putting themselves on the pedestal. Then it's a mutual place of safety. And that's that building block that you're talking about that just creates such a huge environment of healing.
It's huge. And I think the thing, how I explain that to people on my show is they do their best to become the truth teller in your world. And once they become the truth teller, they then are able to isolate you through their truth telling. Mm-hmm. And then once you're isolated and alone, that job has already been done. And now you're separated, and then they can slowly, you know,
chip away piece by piece,
start to chip away. Because when they're the truth teller and they've isolated you, then who are you going to go to? Who else are you going to listen to? They become the authority in your world. And, you know, you're now looking up at them and they're on that pedestal. Mm-hmm. They've knocked you off the pedestal they've put you on at the beginning, which is how they, a lot of the time, they got you into this situation. And then, you know, slowly that starts to go.
Yeah. And you are in the relationship and have no clue. I mean, so many people just have no idea any of this happened. And so you spend the whole time going, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? You know, what do I need to fix? Why am I so broken? And so people mm-hmm. go to therapists and go to counselors to get help for themselves, not realizing that it's the environment they're in that is the problem.
And did you go to a therapist yourself after, or did you do all within the community?
I did go to therapy. I started with a therapist, actually, right off the bat, when I was not really even exploring narcissism yet. My friend had finally talked me into going to a therapist, and I was in his office about 5 minutes, you know, talking about my marriage, when he said, you need to learn about narcissism. You need to explore this word. And he was actually part of the integral piece of getting me outside of my own head, so that I could see the situation a little more clearly. You know, if you're standing so close to a stained glass window, you've got your nose, you know, at a stained glass window, you can't see the picture. All you see is the color green in front of you. Okay. And everybody else is seeing the picture. But until you start to step away and then you go, oh, there's a person. Oh, there's a field. You know, you can start seeing more of the picture. But when we're in these marriages, we are nose to nose with the window and we just can't see it.
This has been a great conversation so far.
Brandon, thank you. Yes, thank you for doing this. Thank you for the time together today. I really appreciate that.
Oh, no, this has really been good. Because, you know, we didn't really have a set structure of what we were going to be talking about. And I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your story.
So what's going on with your practice, your groups, and your show in the future?
So in the groups, I do run group coaching sessions. I run them every couple months. We work for 6 weeks together as a group. And then, you know, we move forward to the next group. And those have been, of all the work that I do, I do offer one-on-one, you know, individual sessions, and they are very powerful as well with that connection. But the group sessions, I think, is where you get the most value because of exactly what we're talking about. You build this little community of people who get it. And so the group sessions are definitely, you know, definitely a huge focus for me. And with the podcast, you know, we're exploring, bringing on different guests. I've really enjoyed getting some other guests. We did a Stories of Hope series just a little while ago where I was having people share their stories kind of in the aftermath, like once they're out of the relationship and in that healing journey. So that's been really powerful. We're going to do some, you know, some episodes coming up about parenting in these situations. I am going to be bringing some of that in, you know, here soon as well. So.
Yeah. The parenting stuff, you know, I am not a parent, and this is how I knew that something was kind of magical about how the show began. And it was about 4 months in, and before I went to bed one night, I said to myself, I need to learn about court. I need to learn about custody. I need to learn about legal issues, post-separation issues, everything, divorce. And I went to bed. I said that out loud. Or at least I said it out loud in my head. I went to sleep. I woke up in the morning, and there was an email from a former public defender in Seattle. And they were now a domestic violence, domestic abuse attorney and family law attorney. And it said, I listened to your show. You need me on your show because you need to learn about divorce. You need to learn about court. You need to learn about custody and everything legal. And then that brought in the aspect of the show of, and that was just kind of magical, but that brought in the idea of like, there's a whole parent world that's going on that I know nothing about. And it's not just how to deal with your ex. It's how to really help your kids mm-hmm. who are dealing with so much and how to be the best parent you can be, even though you're triggered by a lot of things that are coming in. And you need to be the safe and protective parent. And that became like a big thing. And we've done a bunch of episodes with that. But I've learned so much, not just about parenting within these situations, but what it is to be a good parent as a whole.
Right, right.
And all of these little interesting tricks. So like if I see other people's kids, like my friend's kids, I know interesting things that they might not even know how to interact with their children, to have their children be free thinkers and, you know, have their own thoughts and how to get them to be their own little investigators and to really start to have problem solving thinking. So that gives them tools. So I found that also really interesting that in the offshoot of all of this, that I started to learn a lot about just parenting, even though I am not a parent at all. I'm just like the friend who's great with the other person's kids.
No, I think that's awesome. And I love to hear that you've, you know, have gotten on that mission. And I think that's great. I will say this, that, you know, as a martial artist, if I'm teaching a self-defense to somebody, if I am defending myself, then there's one set of skills, that this is my set of skills for my self-defense. But if I'm now in an environment where I'm protecting myself and my children, that's a whole different environment in regards to self-defense. And I now, you know, if it's me, just me without my kids protecting myself in a real world situation, I just have to get away. But if it's me protecting my kids, that self-defense becomes a lot more complicated because I can't just get away. I can maybe, you know, outrun this attacker, but my kids can't, and I can't leave them behind. And so it's a whole different set of skills that is needed when you now have children involved. So it does add a lot of complexity to the situation. So Brandon, thank you for your time. I will be putting in the show notes, you know, how people can find you and reach out, you know, and to you and to join it into your podcast and listen there. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for being here with me today. And I'm going to put all of your stuff, all of your emails, all of your Instagrams, all of your podcast links, website links in my show notes as well. So just thank you for having this conversation with me, and for everyone who's listening, you know, it's, to me, it's like creating community of different shows, and everyone's show has value. And so many people who listen to my show say, you know, they still listen because they need to know that they're not crazy. And the more shows like mine and like yours that are out there, you know, the better. And, you know, so some people say, like, all right, you know, there's other shows, it's competition of your show. I'm like, it's not competition to the show. No. You know, everyone's going to listen to the shows, and yours is a great show. And I want people to listen to your show. As you know, there's people need healing and people need that community. So just a big thank you for being you and doing what you do.
Well, thank you, Brandon. And right back, you know, as well, that thank you for being here for this world. You know, there's so many people out there that we can't possibly be in competition with each other, because we've got a whole world to help. And how can we reach out even more and more? So I thank you for that. We are on that same mission, and I think it's beautiful.
You have been listening to the Covert Narcissism Podcast with your host, Renee Swanson. Be sure to check out our website at www.covertnarcissism.com. There you will find many resources just for you to help you on this journey. You can also reach out to me by email at Renee, R-E-N-E-E, at cnglifecoaching.com. Those letters are CNG, as in Covert Narcissism Group. I do look forward to hearing from you. I wish you so much peace on your journey of healing.
The information provided by Renee Swanson and the Covert Narcissism Podcast is for educational purposes only and is not to be used for diagnosis purposes and not intended to be a substitute for clinical care. Please consult a healthcare provider for guidance specific to your case. This material discusses narcissism in general. It does not claim that any specific person has narcissism and should not be used to refer to any specific person as having narcissism. Permission is not granted to link to or repost this material to support an allegation or a claim that any specific person is a narcissist. That would be an unauthorized misuse of the material and information provided.